Hello and welcome to Culture Sex Relationships with me, Justin Hancock, and us, the listeners, that's you and everyone else. Thanks for downloading and pressing play. So, got another question. So, coming to the end of my questions, by the way, dear listener. So, if listeners, the collective assemblage listening in, so if you do want any more questions answering, if you want to help make the show happen, email me your questions and I'll read them out and answer them, or just chat about them if you've got anything you want to send to me. So that's culturesexrelationships@gmail.com, culturesexrelationships@gmail.com, or there is a link in the show notes for you to send me a more anonymous message without an email, or if you just have ideas for topics you'd like me to explore, let me know. Okay, so here's the question. So this is all about agreeing and disagreeing. No, it's not about agreeing at all. It's about arguing and disagreeing and challenging someone if they have like a transphobic or an otherwise oppressive views. But I won't be talking about any incidents of transphobia. So I don't think there's a content note for this on that score. Okay. So here's the question. Hi, Justin. My favourite episode of yours and Meg John's, so dear listener, if you're new to the show, me and Meg John Barker used to do the show called Meg John and Justin. If you scroll back in the feed, you'll find some of those shows. We did many of them. So my favourite episode of yours and Meg John's is disagreeing with people. I've listened over 10 times. Despite this, I still find myself getting into pointless heated discussions / arguments that leave me very upset, specifically about trans issues, but could be any marginalised group. This is in person, one-to-one, not online. I don't respond on social media. How can I stop getting drawn into doing this? I'm wasting my energy, but find certain things people say to me draw me in. I can't help challenging it. I have multiple marginalised intersectional identities, and I'm gender non-conforming, but not trans myself. Thanks for all the work you put into the podcast. It's part of my self-care. That's very kind of you. Thank you very much for writing in and letting me know that. So I am going to try and just get to the advice more towards the end of the episode. As you know, I'm more like into like the actual giving the advice rather than just talking endlessly about the problem. But I think it's worthwhile talking about why it might be pointless, why I agree with you that it can be pointless. And perhaps as a way of thinking about what else we can do, that's the advice that I'll get to at the end. So there will be actionable materialist advice. not just going to have a moan, dear listener. So, but let's have a moan to start with. First of all, I've put a link in the show notes to the episodes of the Meg, John and Justin podcast that you talked about. I haven't listened, but there is a blog there which reminded me of some of the things that we talked about. And so there might be a little bit of repetition with what I'm about to say, but it's been a few years since we recorded that. I've learned a lot more and read a lot more, so I might have some different things to say, or certainly have some different things to say. And I think in that episode we do talk about the difference between challenging someone and disagreeing with someone, and I think it is really useful just to think about those differences, because I think those two things result in different actions, like they require different actions. And certainly in the work that I do around RSE, there's a big difference between me challenging someone and disagreeing with someone. I never get into disagreements when I'm facilitating relationships and sexuality education, but I do challenge people if they said something which I think is harmful, that might actually be causing some harm in the world or in the lesson. And there are lots of ways to kind of do that, I think, which I'll get into. But I think there is a difference, and it's worthwhile just kind of thinking about this. And actually, I'm going to unpack this in some of the bullet points that I've got in front of me. So here's why it's pointless, or here's why it might be pointless. So point one is that you might not be engaging in the discussion for the same reason. So you might want to change their mind, but they might just want to get you riled up. They might just want to see you get upset. I think that's quite probable, actually, that they might actually just want to see you get upset. So if you're entering into any kind of discussion and you're both wanting, and you're both doing that for very, very different reasons, then the whole discussion, the whole disagreement, the whole point of you talking with each other is just not going to be in good faith, because you're actually not really listening to each other. And so you won't get anywhere. So that's why it is kind of pointless. So in addition to you wanting to change their mind, or you might also just be wanting to stick up for yourself or to stick up for other people, in which case that becomes a completely different dynamic, because they then might want to take part in bullying you or bullying other people. So you're actually also kind of putting yourself at risk there too. You know, if you're having these kinds of discussions or conversations with people who aren't being kind at all and are just arguing in bad faith or just not listening, then, you know, it's just time to break off, because it is pointless, and it's also doing you harm, and they're harming you. And I'm trying not to victim blame here, but it's just good idea to try to reduce the harms where we possibly can, and to avoid the possibility of somebody harming us with views that they know are going to harm us, and that's the only reason that they're sharing those views with us, because they want to harm us. So I think it's really important that we make sure that if you are going to get into a discussion with someone about this, that it's in good faith, and that you're wanting to listen and wanting to learn from each other and open your ears. But how often do we have those discussions? Like, the only time we would really have those kinds of discussions with people is with someone who really loved us and we really loved them, because we really, really wanted to understand where we were coming from. But in which case, you would like to think that somebody who really, really loved you would know that their viewpoints were being hurtful, harmful, causing an actual harm, and so wouldn't do that in the first place, we'd like to think. And if they are, then it's again worth questioning how much time we spend with those people, whether we even refer to them as a loved one. You know, love is something we do, not just something we say. Bell Hooks' book, All About Love, is all about this. You know, I have like a materialist kind of understanding of love. Like, love isn't this imminent thing that exists in and of itself, but it's a series of micro and macro political actions. It's like things that we actually do to make love happen, loving things that we do. And so anyway, sorry, I'm going off on one about love. Anyway, so you might be engaging in the discussion for different reasons. Second reason it's pointless is people rarely change their minds right then and there. So you might say something which might contribute to them rethinking their views, rethinking about understanding whether they're causing harm or not. It's incredibly unlikely that they're going to say to you there and then, "Oh, do you know what? That's really made me think differently about this. I'm gonna think differently from now on." I just don't think that really happens. You know, life isn't like that, sadly. You know, people do change their minds, but people change their minds over kind of longer periods of time, and it's always in relation to, like, often people change their minds because they have either forgotten what their opinion was, have forgotten why they were holding that opinion, or something else has happened that means that opinion is no longer as important to them, or they might have met somebody who has helped change that opinion. So the classic is, you know, homophobia really reduced in the UK. We still have a lot of homophobia in the UK, but it really reduced. And also biphobia and lesbophobia, if we want to get precise, and queerphobia generally. That really reduced the more queer people knew, you know, more gay people knew, more lesbian people knew, or more bi people that people actually knew and met, you know. So, you know, it might change, but people will rarely change their mind from a discussion, from a disagreement, which is happening there and then. So even if you say something useful to them, you're still not going to get the benefit, because they're never going to say to you, "Thank you, that was really useful." Particularly if they're not arguing in good faith, which people, I think, rarely are. Next one, the next reason it's pointless: challenging is very different from disagreeing. So I think it's important to challenge prejudicial remarks or behaviour. I think that's really important. So discriminatory or oppressive behaviours, a bit transphobic or racist or whatever. But that's very different from getting into a disagreement. A challenge is saying, well, you just said that. Just to be clear, I think that is dot, dot, dot. I think that, and then say something, I think it's better to say something affirmative. So, you know, I think that, for example, trans people need legal rights and protections and also better access to healthcare, you know, like we all do. And that's the world that I want to live in. And I think most people want to live in that world. Say something affirmative like that. And then don't get into a disagreement. Don't get into even a discussion. You just say it, okay? And then you can change the subject if you want to. But that's all we have to do. And rather than kind of challenging them on their terms, don't repeat what they've said. Say something which is really affirmative. Say something which is really like pro, okay? Because around all of these things, we are living like the majority opinion in this country is. Broadly, particularly on transphobia, it's particularly the most opinion is basically people have a live and let live approach to it. That's the very least that people have. It's like, well, it doesn't bother me, so why should it? I don't know why it should bother anyone else. Most people think that way, although they might be actually quite pro trans people, trans rights, and again, that's because they know someone who is trans or as you said, gender non-conforming as well. Or they might just see someone on telly, you know. It's like, you know, it's going in this direction. I know it feels like we're in a backlash at the moment about trans stuff, and I'm not trans at all, but I've loved ones who are, and I see them thriving, you know. So that's, you know, despite the fact that we live in this that through a hellish period of transphobia at a political level, like discursively, and, you know, waits for healthcare are horrendous and mental health for trans folk is really awful, I still see trans folk thriving, and most people want to see trans folk thriving in the UK. So just all I'm saying here is say something affirmative, okay, rather than challenging them on their terms. Don't get into disagreements. And that's really about not locking horns. So the key is to challenge without locking horns. So whenever I'm doing work, I never lock horns with people. I never get into arguments or disagreements with them. I would say, you know, I think what you just said there is transphobic or racist or whichever it is. And then I would say something affirmative. And then I'll ask a different question and try to move it on. You know, I might say, it's interesting that you have that view. I wonder what that does for you. Something like that. And I try to be quite matter of fact in my tone about it, and try to understand that, you know, I also want them to, I want it to be like a learning space. If I go around shutting people up and yelling at young people, then, you know, they're not going to come to me they're not going to open up to me, or they're not going to believe me about other stuff, and they might not come to me at the end of the lesson with the question they really, really want to ask me. There's a lot going on in an RSE lesson, and I know what you're not in an RSE lesson by the sounds of it. And when I'm at work and I'm in like professional mode, I'm really prepared for those kinds of moments. And also I've had a lot of experience dealing with this kind of work. As I've said in a previous podcast, I got into my line of work through doing youth work, specifically with young men who had very, like, you know, oppressive views, and my specific work was around challenging this stuff. So I've had a lot of experience of it, and it's not always gone well. I could go into that another time, I think. But I've learned over the years how to do it. So basically, you just try to be as matter of fact as possible. When we challenge someone, we try to be as matter of fact as possible. Say, point out the thing they said is harmful in this particular way, and say something affirmative instead. So replace the negative thing they said with something which is really affirms the rights of the group that you are challenging on behalf of. Okay, so so it was actually a bit of advice there, but back to why it's pointless. So back to the pointless thing. So this is where I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of a psychoanalytic framing of this, which I think is quite useful. My view about psychoanalysis, I think it's really good at pointing out the problems, but terrible at pointing out solutions. So I think it's quite useful here at pointing out the problem. So we might want to think about, if you're getting into a disagreement with someone who's holding these views, think about who is the subject and who is the object. Or when we say object, we might also say other. Let's say other from now on, because I think that's better for the rest of what I'm going to say. So who is the subject? Who is the subject of their own story? Who is the centre of the story? And who is the other here? Who is the other who is like a peripheral character in the central subject story? Now, and again, this is all Freudian psychoanalytic stuff, but also there's a bit about Winnicott here as well that I might talk about, but you know, I don't believe in it, but anyway, I think it's a useful idea. Sorry, I keep repeating myself. Okay, so are you being the subject or are you being the other? I think if you're getting into a disagreement with someone, there is a danger that you make them the subject. Okay, and so really what happens is you become the Freudian mom or dad, right? You become mommy or daddy, which I've written down in my notes because it makes me chuckle. So what happens is that you are this person who is having this really stupid viewpoint. You're making them the subject. And so if you think of them as a teenage kid who doesn't know anything about the world, who is stupidly rebelling against their parent, you in the situation, I think that might be quite a useful way of viewing this dynamic. Okay, they're being stupid. Okay, they're being stupid. They're not listening. They don't care. They're having a little tantrum. They want to be told off by, you know, mum and dad, and they want to, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, they want the little bum spanking. You know, they want to have a little cry about why they're not allowed a curly whirly before their tea. You know, that's how I view these people. Okay, and I find that quite useful, right? And then it just stops me being that person. It stops me from being their mum and dad. It stops me from taking part in this like kind of weird, like Oedipal kind of conversation. Okay. Because actually what might be happening, and this is to my next point about why it's pointless, is that if that is the role that you take, then you might actually be making things worse. So, I mean, as I've been saying lately about non-psychoanalytic theories of consciousness, so a more materialist view of what we mean by consciousness, things become conscious when other people make them conscious. Okay, so when people have a facial expression or something in their body which is demonstrating that they are being affected by something or being affected by you or somebody else, other people around that person help that person make that affect become a feeling or become an emotion or a thought and then something they might act on. It's about we're making something become conscious. And what worries me here is that if you're constantly getting into, you know this as well because you've said it's pointless, but if you are frequently getting into disagreements with people, you're making the thing that they're saying become more conscious because they're thinking about it more. And you're giving them the opportunity to argue their point more and to have other people to whom they speak to, which makes that argument become more. Okay, and then they might report this back to other people who might agree with them, talking about their interaction with you, and say, oh yeah, this person had nothing for the arguments I said about this, like completely misreporting what what the discussion was, making up a load of bullshit about you, about the conversation and about you. And so what happens is you've just made it that little bit more conscious. Okay, so actually it might be having the opposite effect. I think this sometimes might explain some of what we know as being, I think it's mostly a psychological term, but backfire effects. So there are lots of backfire effects when we try to convince somebody to do something. So I wrote a piece, I think we might have done, me and Meg John might have done a podcast about this, maybe, I don't know. But I wrote a piece for Bish, which I'll put in the show notes, about how to convince someone to get their vaccine, which is insanely dated now. But it's got some useful stuff in there. And it talks about backfire effects. And so if you get into an argument with someone, then they all they do is to remember their position, and their position becomes stronger. And so it's kind of like a backfire effect. Okay, so this is why it's really useful just to challenge it. Don't make it bigger, and say something affirmative. Okay, if you are going to say anything at all, I'm going to suggest we might not even have to say anything in a moment, which is perhaps controversial. But if you are going to say something, just say the one thing, be as matter-of-fact as possible, have an affirmative kind of motto, have like an affirmative kind of like a mantra that you might say in that moment, and then leave it. Leave them. Like, don't make them become more conscious. What if we allowed these people just to go back to the social periphery where these thoughts never became conscious and it was just something in their heads that was never said out loud, and then conservative politicians didn't try and make policy on it or get votes on it, and they just kind of quietly just went away, these thoughts. And if we don't make them conscious in these people's heads, then we're also doing them a favour, because actually they might go back to being normal again rather than constantly fighting on these just issues that don't even really affect them. Anyway, sorry, having another side kind of thought there. Okay, so and the next reason, last reason, it's pointless. It's probably more like I'm kind of just having thoughts here about materialism, and I'm kind of just to go back on the last point I was saying. You know, what does so challenging can be useful. Challenging can be good because you're saying you're just affirming something else in the world, and you're reminding that person and anyone else around them, whether they're listening or not, or whether anyone's there, you're just kind of reminding the world, you're putting it out there. Most people are in favour of trans rights. Most people are in favour of trans people having a nice life. On the specifics around particular things like sport and all the tricky, hard topics, there are stronger disagreements. But generally speaking, people are like more pro-trans than not. Or at least don't care as much as these people that you're arguing with. So just reminding them and the universe of that is really just, I think, just an important thing to do. But again, if we're disagreeing with someone and we're allowing these views to be aired more, you know, if it gets aired once and then in like one sentence, and one sentence becomes two sentences or three sentences and four sentences, and then although what you're trying to do is argue against them, you know, in a kind of a slightly like metaphysical way of thinking, yes, you're rebutting their arguments, and yes, you're probably making much more sense and saying many more factual things for everything, every bad thing they say. Every bad discourse is being met with like good discourse, and you're trying to like replace it. What do we just kind of end up with? We just end up with more of it in the world, okay? And the more times these words are being said in the world, materially, because words are matter as well, you know, that that is in relation to other matter. And so it's just kind of making it become more, okay? I'm being quite basic about this, but really, you know, this is an argument for just not talking to these people at all. You know, I mean, we might still want to challenge people, and again, but sometimes it might not feel safe to challenge people, or you might just think, I'm just going to move away instead. I mean, sometimes I don't think we have to challenge people. If there is someone else around who is more at risk of harm from you, then the thing to do, or if you're at risk of harm from the things that they're saying, or if there's somebody else at risk of harm from the things that they're saying, challenging might be one of the strategies we might use to help make that place more safer. But nothing is safer than getting away from that place. Like, you could just walk away, just walk out, you can leave. My girlfriend has an amazing t-shirt about this. And then other people can, you know, address this person, or you could address, why has this shithead been invited to this party, or, you know, what the fuck's he doing here again? If he comes to this, or if they come to this, or if she comes to this again, I'm not coming again. So, or we can't be friends, etc. But I think the thing of challenging people there and then is kind of sometimes overrated. It sometimes forgets that that can be a challenging thing to do. It can be a very difficult and sometimes harmful thing to do, putting ourselves in kind of harm's way. It forgets that not everybody has the same level of agency to be able to the capacity to be able to challenge these things. And sometimes, yeah, it just might not be a good idea. So we could also just literally turn our backs on these people and just walk away. Right, so let's get to the next part of this, which is why you're getting drawn in. Which is, I guess, like, so you know why it's pointless. You know that it feels like a waste of time. And it leaves you feeling, you say here, it leaves you very upset. I'll get to that in a minute, but it's like, so you know that it's pointless, but why? And so I can't answer this for you, but I've got some ideas, like a couple of ideas that might just help you to think about this. So one is another kind of, so one useful idea here about that comes from like psychoanalysis again, is to turn what I was just saying about the subjects and the object. So if you're wanting to argue with this person who's saying this thing, which is really like what you're finding is problematic or harmful or upsetting or something you think that you disagree with and you need to say something out loud, are they your inessential other? So is you arguing with them somehow making yourself become more conscious? And here I'm thinking, I'm kind of doing a reversal of one of the things that Jacob Johansson talks about and his excellent book, Male Fantasy, The Misogyny, Fantasy, and Online Manosphere. Anyway, I did a podcast with him about it, and he's got this really super useful idea, which is drawn from Klaus Telewijt, who wrote Male Fantasies, and Wilhelm Reich, who was a psychoanalyst, but initially in the Freudian tradition, but then took off in a completely different like tradition. And basically his thing was all about how the problems happen in the psyche when we repress sexual urges or we inhibit sexual urges. Anyway, so I'm massively oversimplifying what Jacob had to say in his really excellent book. And hopefully if you listen to the podcast, you'll get a flavour of why the book is so useful and so important. But it's this, I think it's his concept of disinhibition, which he talks about. And basically the idea is that, so between the First World War and the Second World War, there were a bunch of tooled up kind of mercenaries in Germany, like wandering around, wanting to have the war again, like just wanting to fight. And this became, they became the Freikorps, who then became members of the SS in the lead up to the Second World War, committing obviously huge number of fascistic atrocities and killings. But in Klaus Telewijt's book Male Fantasies, he talks about how they would protect themselves with this kind of psychological kind of armor, this kind of thick armor on the outside. Everything inside the armor is good, psychologically speaking, unconsciously speaking. Everything outside is really bad. And Jacob was talking about this in relation to the manosphere. So these men who go online, who say these awful things about women and queer folk. And so what they do is to create this kind of ogre of an other that they need. So they create this ogre, this imagined other. And sex educators are part of this as well. And Tories are doing it at them. As we speak, the Tories are doing it. Whenever I see cultural bollocks, I see them doing this. Like, but what they need is that these men, that they need, in order for them to exist, in order for them to have any kind of subjectivity at all, in order for them to be a subject, they have to create this other that they need to be in opposite to be in a conflict with, that they need to simultaneously keep alive and destroy, okay? Because that their entire existence relies on them existing. This kind of fantasy of this other, you know, these you know, like the latest thing in, from, you know, Tory politicians is this, you know, the Islamist gay, fully automated, gay-based luxury acid communist who's coming to indoctrinate their children with Islamist, trans, gay, pride. You know, it's all like a word salad at this moment. And so what they're doing is they're creating this ogre of this thing. They need that. And then they're saying it's really bad. We need to kill it. And that's where they derive their self from, their subjectivity from. Does that make sense? So this psychological idea, like this psychoanalytic idea, is basically like, as a self, we need an other. And we need that other to exist in order for ourselves to exist. Now, to kind of turn this in a much more kind of kind and gentle way, these men, why am I assuming that they're men? I'm so sorry, you've not said that they're men at all. These men, women, or you might even be arguing with non-binary folk about this. Whoever you're arguing with, the reason I said men is because I was thinking about Jacob's book and the Manosphere, but anyway, back and the Freikorps who were men. Anyway. But back to your situation, dear listener. Sorry, I'm really going off on one, but I hope you're finding this interesting. So the people that you're arguing with, they are perhaps, as I was saying earlier, they are relying on you to help them become conscious because you are their other and you're like their parent to their teenage kind of like, you know, tantrums. Okay. And they want you to spank them on the bum and then they'll be like, oh, you know, that's great. And it's all kind of weird. Anyway. But then in a much more kind and affirmative way, just check in with yourself about whether you're doing this for them. So, because this might be a useful thing for you. So you do talk about how you have you are gender non-conforming. You're not trans yourself, you're gender non-conforming. But is there something there about what, ask yourself, what does it do when I get into these arguments with people? You say it makes you very upset, but what else does it do? Like, if it gives you a sense of your own subjectivity, of if it gives you a sense of affirmation about you and how you feel about your gender, you know, and if it's making you kind of feel a little bit more confident, and if you're doing it in a way which is not fascistic, so Deleuze and Guattari talk about micro-fascisms, it's important that we don't kind of do fascist things back to fascist people, you know, and that we do these things in good faith, but you know, I'm not saying do to them what they've been doing to you, but whatever you're getting, are you getting anything out of it whatsoever? Okay. Because that might help you to think, well, if I'm getting something out of this, if there is something I'm getting out of this to do with how I feel about myself or my gender, then you might think, ask yourself the question, how else do I feel really good about my gender? In what other aspects of my life do I feel more of a subject? Okay, think of times in your day-to-day life when you do feel more of a subject, and see if you can come up with a list of all the other times, all the other occasions, all the other relationships that you have where you do feel more yourself, and whether you might be able to lean on those a little bit more. If you can lean on those a little bit more, you might just find yourself less inclined to be having arguments with people that make you very upset. Okay? The other thing you might want to think about as well here, just kind of related to this point, is think about those times when you haven't been drawn in. So you say that you don't have these discussions online or on social media, which I think takes tremendous amount of restraint. How? Like, how have you managed that? Like, how do you manage to completely ignore all the wrong opinions on the internet from, you know, arseholes? How do you manage that? What do you do? Okay. Or there might have been a time when you didn't get into a disagreement, or there might have been a time where you did, but it wasn't upsetting. Where you did, but you were able to be like, well, I'm just saying this. So, and you said something affirmative, maybe, and you're like, you just left it at that and turned and walked away or talked about something else or whatever. What were you doing in those moments? Like, what did you learn about yourself? What do you know about yourself that told you you were handling that well in a way that you were really pleased to notice. Try to, if you can, think of a moment where a specific time and place where you were really pleased to notice how you dealt with one of these situations. Really try to replay it in your mind and bring to mind all the things that you were pleased to notice and bring to mind all the resources that you have. Make a list. Say them out loud. Saying them out loud actually is more helpful, apparently. And again, I'm drawing on solution-focused therapy here, which I think is really, as I keep talking about, really, really useful. And also related to this. So, as I was saying at the beginning, often when people get into arguments with us about these kinds of things, they're not actually wanting to have a sit down or a cup of tea and really thrash this out and air arguments and listen properly to each other, you know, like Frost Nixon or whatever. That is not what is happening, right? Often what is happening is that they're saying something to deliberately wind you up, or they're saying something that they don't feel that upset about, maybe. Or maybe they are upset about something and they want you to be upset as well. And so really what we're talking about here is affect. So we're talking about the level of affect. And so I'll just kind of go through this again. There's more about this in the zine, actually, that I'm working on at the moment. It's been a bit of a hiatus on the zine. But I've written a few pages of a new zine, which is available at my Patreon, patreon.com/culturesexrelationships. Dear listener to this, you didn't leave me your email address or anything. Or maybe you did. I'll send you, if you didn't leave me your email address, send me an email and say, can you send me this thing from your zine, please, Justin? But if you did leave your email address, I'll email that to you at some point. Anyway, sorry, just talking to the listener. The specific listener, not the listener assemblage. You are all listeners. You're all a multitude. It's a lot of you. There might be like 1,000 of you, but actually because you're a multitude, it's probably like 10, 20, 30, 40,000. You know, it might be 40 million of you. Who knows? Anyway, so going to talk about affect, feelings / emotions. Well, what I mean is actually affect / feelings, emotions, thoughts, and what we do. So I think this is a really useful way of thinking about how we respond and how we react and how we deal with the external world. So this again is kind of like we're drawing on materialism here. Okay, so there are always things that we're affected by in the external world. I'm talking about like the philosopher Baruch Spinoza here, or Benedictus de Spinoza, depending on who we listen to. So Spinoza is basically saying, look, that we are, that there are affects, and we're all to be affected by the external world, people, external world, things that other matter in the world, and we experience two affects. One, we have an increased capacity to act, or the other, which is a decreased capacity to act. So the first is joy, the second is sadness. Again, there's more about this in my zine that I've been trying to make on the Patreon. So, but also in the way I'm going to talk about affects here, we're all affected in our bodies. When we encounter the external world, we feel it in our bodies first. It's like we get these bodily reactions. Okay, so what are your bodily reactions? What happens in your body just before that moment when you open your mouth to disagree with someone? Like, can you locate that somewhere? You know, so for example, if your sympathetic nervous system has been activated and you're in like stress mode, you're in like react mode, then you might notice some things like an increase in your heart rate, a sharp intake of breath, quicker breathing, more tunnel vision. Your hearing might get a bit occluded because you're trying to adjust to the frequencies of things that might be causing you harm rather than necessarily the people kind of in front of you. You might just feel more blood pumping to your extremities. You might just feel kind of, you know, like ready, like in react mode. But I don't know. But what happens for you, dear listener, when you're in this kind of mode, okay? And as soon as you can kind of locate that moment, then you might start to understand, okay, I'm having a feeling. And this feeling is, I'm being attacked, I'm feeling upset, I'm protecting somebody, I'm sticking up for someone, just in a kind of like reactive kind of way. And then when you've got to that, when you've got to like the feelings level, you might then get to a more emotional response, a more kind of a more articulated emotional response. So I'm feeling angry that this person said that this person over here is saying this transphobic thing, and it's making me feel really angry, or it's making me feel sad, or a combination of angry and sad, or I'm worried about my friend, or I'm worried about me, or I'm worried about the world, or whatever emotions. You know, me and Meg John used to just go with the five emotions from Inside Out, but there are many, many more emotional states that you can pay attention to. So what might be the emotional state that you're in? What might you think? So this is when, you know, you're becoming really conscious of this moment here. So you might start to think something else. You might start to think, well, you might start to kind of apply your previous experiences and think, okay, well, this person's doing this. Or you might notice your previous experiences with this and be like, well, in the past when I've done this, this has happened. So in this occasion, I might try this other thing. Maybe you might remember to do something like breathe out or blink. Or get a sip of water or something, or just kind of look around and try to ground yourself a little bit, see if you can hear a bird singing. When I was getting angry listening to Rishi Sunak the other day making that announcement on the steps of, you know, on Downing Street, when he was saying that anyone who goes on a Palestine solidarity march is basically, you know, Hamas, and like threatening to shut down lawful peaceful protests, you know, as well as getting angry at what I was saying, I was noticing, because it was tea time, the blackbirds on Downing Street were all kind of singing to each other and, like, you know, saying, oh, good night, blackbird, okay, good night, yeah, all right then, yeah, see you tomorrow, yeah, have a worm on me, yeah, okay. And that made me feel slightly less angry, you know. Anyway, massive side note. So you might remember some of the things that you've done in the past that have been like a helpful strategy in that moment, and then you might apply the strategy, or you might do something. You might think of some of the things we discussed today in our conversation, where we talked about maybe this needs a challenge, maybe I just need to walk away, who is the person who is least safe being around this person, do I need to find somebody else to intervene on their behalf, what can I do? And this way, by paying attention to this kind of affect / feeling, emotion, thoughts, actions, you might just be able to just slow it down, like just to notice this tiniest moment where you're able to just catch yourself and be like, all right. And then you might be able to respond in a way which is better for you, where you're not getting so upset, and it might actually be better for everyone else, including your interlocutor, including the potential, you know, idiot teenage child who wanted his, you know, their or her curly whirly. though, you know, quite why you'd be arguing with someone who goes with a they pronoun about trans rights, I don't know, but, you know, might happen anyway. I'm just trying to be inclusive. So it might actually be kind to them, because instead of immediately responding to what they're saying, you might be able to say something really smart. You might be able to say something, oh, you know, it's interesting. I think most people are like broadly in favour of trans rights, and that's certainly what I think, and we need better healthcare for everyone. But I wonder, what does that do for you, having that opinion? You know, just wondering about that. You know, what does that do for you? How's that going? You know, if you wanted to ask a different question, like changing the terms and drawing a new line of flight and thinking, okay, what else can this conversation be? Or you could say, oh, well, how come you know this person? You know, presumably, you know, maybe sometimes when you're meeting these people, they're friends of friends or friends of friends of friends. But, you know, you could just say this thing. And then because you just kind of, you've not got upset, and you've just been able to check in with yourself and check in with the resources that you've got, that you know that you have, okay, because you've been able to do that, you're able to just hold that space. And it's like, oh, yeah, how do you know this person? Interesting. Yeah, okay. And talk about something else. And if you can find some common ground, and I think we talked about this in the episode that me and Meg John did, if you can find other common ground, that's not to say that, you know, I'm not saying we should all be friends with transphobes. I'm not saying that. But there might be a situation where a useful strategy might just be to be the really cool person who listened to what they said, asked a different kind of question, and instead of making their transphobic view or whatever their oppressive view become conscious, helped them become more conscious of something else. Like understanding the possibilities of not saying these things all the time, not blurting these things out, not being this child who's desperately seeking this kind of, you know, attention. There's the child who wants the curly-whirly, right? I don't know why I've got this in my head, but I'm just imagining this spoilt brat whose every ill, kind of every stupid, ill-thought-out whim and idea in their head is mollycoddled by their idiot parents, and they're always given their curly-whirly or whatever. But what might this do for the other person? Like, for them to be around somebody who can say something really cool and affirmative about trans stuff in a way which is where they're not upset, but you just really like just matter of fact and owning it and being fucking boss about it. And you're just being like, you're just like, you know, you're the governor. You're like, you know, you're the dog's bollocks in the situation. Your shoulders are back. You know, you're kind of, you've got this kind of inner swagger and confidence that you can say these things and blah, what does that do for you? You know, how's that going? You know, how do you know such and such? Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. What's that you're drinking over there? And, you know, oh yeah, you know, what might that do for that person? What might that do for that person's views? Okay. If they might think, well, if I didn't just blurt these things out all the time, I might be able to be friends with cool people like this. And then what might happen? And then what might happen? So when we start to draw different lines of flight in this way and thinking about what else, and I'm using the word lines of flight, the phrase lines of flight here. Again, this is from Deleuze and Guattari. Yes, I have just been reading about this, so you're welcome. It's in 1,000 Plateaus. It's called 1848, The Three Novellas. It's the plateau of 1,000 Plateaus. It's excellent. Anyway, when you draw that line of flight, then you're not being a bad comrade by getting into a disagreement or challenging someone's transphobia. You're doing something way more powerful because you're suggesting by you're able to affect them and to be this cool person that might be someone that you might be someone they want to be. They might want to become more conscious of something else, in which case they might then start thinking, I'm not going to say so many transphobic things out loud. And what happens when people stop saying so many transphobic things out loud? It gets a bit smaller. People do less transphobic things, ideally. And they don't then go and make more people transphobic in their discussions with other people. They don't double down on their transphobia in their discussions that they had that they're having with their transphobic friends about the argument they had with you. Okay? So by paying attention to how you respond to these things, and not only is it a win for you, it's potentially a win-win for them, but also macro-politically, it's a macro-political win. It's a big win in the fight against transphobia. Okay? Does this kind of make sense? I hope so. I think this is kind of like an important part of the project. It's just to not get involved just on their terms and to only be involved at this kind of like discursive level, because we affect people in lots and lots of different ways. And you could affect people by being, you know, the cool person at the party who's just that little bit cooler than everyone else. And I think we could all do with being a bit more of that, particularly those of us who are interested in having a better world. I think we have a, you know, I think that sometimes it's like people think if I'm doing the work on myself in this way, then that is somehow not good politically, because then it's about, you know, only improving the neoliberal self. But actually, well, A, if we're not doing it, then no one else is doing it for us. So it's the classic, we've got to put our oxygen mask on before we can help anyone else. But also, two, I've just explained the possibilities of this micro-politically, right? That there's no point going around making ourselves upset, knowing that it's a waste of time and it's pointless, but doing it anyway because it's what we're supposed to do if we're a good comrade. Like, really, there are lots of different ways of doing this and drawing a new line of flight wherein we become the Fonz or somebody else cool. I'm trying to think as who's cooler than the Fonz. You know, I mean, yes, he was the school drug dealer, wasn't he? Because he was just, you know, he's a man in a leather jacket who rode a bike, hanging around in men's toilets with teenagers. You know, it's not that cool, really, in some respects, the Fonz. But in other senses, he was very cool. You know, I'm sure he was a nice guy. I'm sure he was DBS checked and everything. And he just seemed to get on with everyone. Anyway. Okay, so that's the podcast. I hope you found that useful, dear listener. If you have any questions you would like me to overthink, either questions of your own, or if you hear or see or read any advice given out there in the media and you think it was shit, let me know and I can do a better version. You know, I don't like dunking on other people, but if you send me something that was rubbish, send me a question that was given a rubbish answer, I'll simply just give it a better answer and see what that does. And if you fancy supporting the show and getting access to the zine I was telling you about, as well as some extra bits and bobs and shows, head to patreon.com/culturesexrelationships. If you would like to book a solution-focused coaching session with me, a session or two, I should say, with me, it can work after one session, but much more like to work after two. You can book a session with me. Go to justinhancock.co.uk/coaching, and you can see all my other work at justinhancock.co.uk. And if you want to buy any of the zines or check out the Meg, John and Justin blog, that's still up. We've not added to it because we don't work together anymore. But megjohnandjustin.com/publications if you want to find those zines. All right, then. They are the final notices. And please do email with your questions, culturesexrelationships@gmail.com. Or find the link in the show notes where you can send me a message via the Google form. Or you can just send me a DM via any of the platforms that you might find me on or follow me on. I am going to stop talking now. I'm going to go and get a cup of tea. And so I'll check in with you all later. All right then. Ciao.